It's the takeaway for July 18th, and San Juan is hearing the voices of the Puerto Rican people. Calls for Puerto Rico's Governor Ricardo Rosselló to resign are only getting louder. We're talking how collective anger over government corruption and the aftermath of Hurricane Maria is reaching a tipping point for Puerto Ricans.
I wish I was on the island right now with my people, but I am beyond proud. My heart doesn't even fit in my chest. I am so elated with all of this.
Also on the show, Ellie Mistal joins us to talk about how the Trump administration is changing the face of American justices and why printed cookbooks are still doing well in the age of food blogs.
There's something about reaching for that book on the shelf and those splattered pages. There's something important about the physical connection to that item and the physical action of cooking.
We've got a lot to get to, so let's get started. For the past few days, protesters in Puerto Rico have continued to surround Governor Ricardo Rosselló's residence, La Fortaleza, in San Juan, at times clashing with police. On Wednesday, celebrities like Latin trap artist Bad Bunny, singer Ile, and pop star Ricky Martin joined the protesters.
We're tired of the cynicism. They put down women. They put down the LGBT community. People with disabilities. Corruption. It is insane. We are tired. We can't take it anymore.
Puerto Ricans on the island and around the world are demanding that Governor Rosselló resign following a scandal over offensive text messages that included comments against journalists, women, and political opponents. The text scandal, which some have called WikiLeaks, comes days after the FBI indicted six former government officials and contractors on corruption charges, including money laundering. And the protests mark an ongoing frustration that's been building up for years, including a massive economic crisis and the fallout from Hurricane Maria. Here to help us make sense of it all are two journalists on the ground in Puerto Rico. I'm joined by David Begno, lead national correspondent at CBS This Morning, and Bianca Padro Ocasio is a reporter with the Miami Herald, and we welcome you both.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
David, we've covered this on the show, but a lot has happened over the last few days. Is Puerto Rico at a tipping point?
I think it's past a tipping point, but I think the context of it all is very important. As one woman said to me last night, the leaked chat messages was the final straw. This has been decades of corruption and mismanagement from multiple administrations. Look, Residente said last night, we're not exactly just targeting Rosselló. It just isn't about only him, right? But he's the guy there right now, right? You know, so many people have said to me, David, don't just let the reporting get caught up in the offensive chats. But I did see a lot of people last night who said, no, let's talk about those offensive chats. You hear from the 70-year-old retired school teacher who was so profoundly offended, Ricky Martin, who was targeted with these remarks. I mean, the things that they said in these chats were disgusting, right? Making fun of the bodies piling up at the morgue. That's not an opinion. That's if you read it, it's disgusting. That's an observation within the reporting, right? So that's the context of the situation. I think Puerto Ricans would tell you we're beyond the tipping point, and that's why we're in the streets.
I mean, as a Puerto Rican woman myself, I've never seen this level of activism on the island and in the broader diaspora. Bianca, the turmoil in Puerto Rico has drawn the attention, as David mentioned, and we had at the top of the show, Ricky Martin was there, Bad Bunny, and others. What is their role? Are they a critical piece of the protest puzzle, in your opinion?
I think they absolutely have a lot of clout, not just in Puerto Rico, but in the diaspora. I think they made these calls to show up to protest. And, you know, Ricky Martin was one of the targets in this Telegram chat that was leaked. There were homophobic comments made against him and others. So, you know, what they say has a lot of weight. And even Residente, the rapper from the group Calle 13, he was in Old San Juan up until 2 in the morning with thousands of motorbikes that were entering Old San Juan. And I don't know for those listeners who haven't been there, these are very narrow streets. They're cobblestone. So having thousands of motorbikes coming in at 2 in the morning when riot police are trying to disperse the area. It was pretty powerful to experience and witness some of that last night.
David, I was on the ground in during the protest in Ferguson in 2014, and I've noticed, at least on the surface here, some similarities between what we saw there in terms of rubber bullets and tear gas. What are you seeing in terms of how the law enforcement is interacting with the protesters right now?
Look, I will tell you this. It's always a hot button issue. There are people here in Puerto Rico who have long-standing resentment with the police. So some folks come into protests with the notion of the police are bad, the protesters are great, and the police come in thinking we're the right ones and the protesters are bad. Let me tell you exactly what we saw. Up until about 9 p.m., 10 p.m., everything was peaceful. It loud, unified, but peaceful. There were plastic water bottles that were thrown at police, and this went on for an hour. Four or five would be lobbed, and you'd have 10 minutes of nothing. Then four or five would be lobbed toward police, then you'd have nothing. This went on and on, but the police never really got triggered. What was interesting, and if you look at the video, there was a moment where something appeared to be thrown from the protesters to the police, and off camera you see a flash. And then there's another piece of video that shows a police officer holding something in his hand that ignites. And all these fireworks start going off behind the police, on the police side. And so even this morning, journalists are still trying to figure out how did these firework-type devices get... Let's say someone did throw one piece of firework from the protest side to the police. Well, there were more fireworks that went off. So why were there fireworks behind the police? What was that all about? So still trying to ascertain that. But that's what we saw happen last night.
Now, David, you've been covering this story for quite some time. And we mentioned the chat messages that were leaked by the Centro de Periodismo Investigativo in Puerto Rico here, 900 pages of them. And the media was part of that. And I believe you were one of the people who was mentioned in these chat messages. How has Rosselló responded to the media and specifically to your questions to him so far?
Well, it's interesting. Let me start with the latter. So we've been asking for a one-on-one interview, and he won't give it. He had a press conference, which we went to, and I had 8 questions for him. He answered every one of them. I wouldn't exactly call them answers, though. I would call them responses. One thing about Ricardo Rosselló is he falls on the sword about certain things. He will come right out and say it was shameful what I did, which is what he said. But he won't answer hypotheticals like, whose support do you have? What would it take for you to resign? Listen, you have to acknowledge when there are close to 100,000 people marching down narrow streets in a beautiful city that sits on a hill in the middle of the Caribbean, you have to acknowledge that is a game-changing, sit up, take notice, and maybe not do business as usual type of event. Now, he says that it's not business as usual, but if you look at his Twitter account, that he loves to tweet, he's having meetings that talk about anything but what is going on here. And the government was promoting this morning a cruise ship that arrived. They were like, oh, look, the cruise ship arrived, 6,000 people. Well, this is on the heels of the last 48 hours where a couple of cruise ships passed by the island because they didn't want to stop given the unrest. He does not want to sit down for an interview. That obviously would involve targeted questions. He's happy to say, I screwed up, I apologize. I haven't worried about it. I'm not trying to get an apology. This story is not about me. He can say whatever he wants. He has been on a bit of an apology tour, I'm told. But as it pertains to the media, I mean, listen, you know, politicians complain about the media. It's the price of doing business.
I'm speaking with journalist David Begno and Bianca Padro Ocasio about the political crisis in Puerto Rico. Bianca, we just learned that a new story from the Puerto Rico Center for Investigative Journalism published last night alleges that many of the people who are implicated in the chats have been involved in other contracts and diverting of public funds. Do we expect more heads to roll at this point?
I think the overall sentiment from Puerto Ricans, especially on the heels of what happened yesterday, is that this is going to keep going. No one thinks that this is the end of it. No one thinks that the 6 indictments of former government officials is the last of it, because this is a moment where the open secret of government corruption is now actually undeniable. So to actually have people in the chat and have evidence that there was something fishy going on while Puerto Rico was negotiating hurricane recovery funds, while Puerto Rico was negotiating Medicaid funds, I think to people, it's shocking because now there's no way of denying it. But this is something that, to put it in context, you know, as one woman said to me last night, this is not just about Ricardo Rosselló. This is about an ongoing crisis of corruption that has been hidden from the public, even though everyone kind of knew about it. So, you know, it was an excellent report that the Centro de Periodismo Investigativo did last night that they released amid all the protests. And Elías Sánchez is not expected to be the only one to be connected to the scandal.
David, we've seen a number of senior members in the Rosselló administration already resign in the wake of the scandal. Question for you now. If Governor Rosselló himself resigns or is impeached, what is the line in succession here? I mean, what would happen next?
It would be the Secretary of State, Lieutenant Governor. But guess what? He resigned effective yesterday. And that was a bit of a circus. So he resigned this past weekend, and we were told he was out. And then on Monday, we were told, well, he's actually staying till the end of the month. And then yesterday, we were told, oh, no, he's out. The transition's done. He's gone. So that is the line of succession. The Secretary of in Puerto Rico, the Secretary of State is also the Lieutenant Governor. But the position's vacant. So there's, you know, kind of a placeholder. So, you know, what I'm being told is that the party officials are trying to figure out who fills that, you know, working with the governor to figure out who fills that spot. In case Rosselló does end up vacating the office, the big question is they want to get in the person they like, right? That's what I'm hearing is some of the back channel discussions. But listen, let's be clear. The governor is not for one moment signaling he has any thoughts of leaving. I mean, I texted a spokesperson last night in the middle of the protest, and I said, given everything that's going on now, what you're seeing on television, has the governor's resolve to remain in office changed in any way? And I was told, absolutely not. He was elected. He's staying. That's it.
So we've got about a minute left in the segment, David, and I'm curious if we've seen any response from the United States so far to this, specifically President Trump, and whether or not we're expecting even more protests.
Yeah, good question. So Trump has not tweeted about it, which is very telling. He goes off on things Puerto Rico related. We did get a statement from the White House that essentially said, we told you so.
And are we expecting more protests in the days to come? Is there a sense that this is just going to keep going until there's any change?
We haven't heard of another big one like the one last night, but I would not be surprised. And don't forget the protests are popping up in New York City and Austin and Miami and Orlando and Seattle.
And we've seen some around the world as well. Bianca, any last words on the hashtag Ricky Renuncia? We've got about 30 seconds to go.
I think protesters are promising, and especially after last night, that they will keep showing up. Like David said, we haven't heard any big protests going on, but this is not something that is going to go away so easily.
Okay, David and Bianca, thanks so much for joining us. David Begno is lead national correspondent for CBS This Morning, and Bianca Padro Ocasio is the reporter with the Miami Herald and El Nuevo Herald. Anger over the situation in Puerto Rico has also reached Puerto Ricans around the world, especially in the continental U.S., where more than 5 million Puerto Ricans live. There have been rallies this week in Miami and New York City, and you're hearing voices from those cities there. With the number of Puerto Ricans living in the mainland U.S. exceeding the number of Puerto Ricans on the island, we turn now to the diaspora to hear their thoughts on the unfolding crisis on the island. I have two guests who were born and raised in Puerto Rico and whose families are still there. Nicole Acevedo is here in the studio with me, and she's a reporter with NBC News Digital. Thanks for being with us, Nicole.
Thank you.
And joining us from Los Angeles is Vico Ortiz, an L.A.-based Latinx actor and activist. Vico, thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
So let me start with you, Vico. When we hear about these protests on the island in the continental U.S., what were your initial thoughts? What are your reactions to that?
I am absolutely thrilled. I am beyond proud. My heart doesn't even fit in my chest. I am so elated with all of this. I haven't seen anything like this in so long. So I'm just really, I wish I was on the island right now with my people. But thankfully, there's a solid group of us in LA. So we gathered yesterday to
do some organizing, and we did a video, and then we'll have a protest on Saturday as well. So I'm excited.
Nicole, let's talk about you. I mean, the protests are now here. We had protests yesterday in New York and LA, around the country, really, and even around the world. The diaspora is, shall we say, fired up. But this is this what makes this moment different for you?
I think this is one of the first times that, you know, the diaspora always reacts to, you know, whenever there's a disaster in the island. We saw in Hurricane Maria, the diaspora has a great power to activate when the island is in crisis. But we basically echo and amplify what happens in the island. And what we've seen is that people from all walks of life, like we had Ricky Martin, like, you know, you had tens of thousands of people. And I saw people using the hashtag in Spain, Ireland, Australia, Japan. That says something. And I think that's unprecedented right now.
Miko, what are your reactions to that? I mean, when you see this not extending not just to the United States and LA, but around the world, you know, for me, I was pretty surprised. I don't think I've ever seen the diaspora activated like that. What's your response, Miko?
I mean, even though we've done a lot of like outreach and people are listening to us, I wish there was even more. I mean, I'm very active on social media, and if it wasn't because I was posting, like, none of my friends in LA who are in Puerto Ricans would know what's happening. There isn't that much like big press still riling up. I mean, there is something, and it's fantastic. But I say, let's get louder.
And adding to that point, Puerto Rico, it's an island where 3.2 million people live. That's equivalent to like how many people live in Iowa or Nevada. If tens of thousands of people rallied outside the governor's mansion asking him to resign, that would be everywhere in the United States. And for some reason, it's not to that level yet. I think we're getting there. But like Vico, you were saying, like, there needs to be more, and I think it will happen.
In terms of, you're referring to media coverage.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Vico, go ahead.
What I love about this is not a socialist movement or a nationalist movement or a political. It's not the PNPs or the PPDs this is like the people are gathering together, all ages, all sides, for one cause. And I mean, obviously, this is a pileup of different situations that happened in the island, and this was the last drop that made the glass overflow. But this is not like one side, I guess, the other side. It's like the people together have united, and not just in the island, but like all over the world. So that's huge.
And I want to follow up on that with Nicole in your thoughts, because when we do talk about Puerto Rico, I know growing up it was always, you know, you had statehood or the Commonwealth, you know, the status quo, and this very thin margin of people who wanted to be independentistas, independent. Where does this movement now take us? Does it take us, to Vico's point, I mean, it's not necessarily political, but everything is political to a certain extent, right?
I mean, there's a reckoning with the party system right now in Puerto Rico. Right now, like, even the people that support statehood, which is the main party right now, the party of the governor, they're saying, you know, man, if you want to be part of the United States, you know, you're not looking great. You're not making things work for the United States to want to even think about making Puerto Rico a state. You know, so you have people in that party, you know, kind of having that struggle. You know, it's like, well, this man was supposed to root for statehood, but he's not doing anything to help the cause. And then you also have the people that are saying, wow, like, we love Puerto Rico and we can't believe that, you know, what those chats revealed. Let's put this in context. This was between December and January, a year after Maria. People were still reeling from that pain. And that's not reflected in those chats, you know? And I think grappling with that reality, people were like, you know what? If in the worst time in our history, you weren't able to step up, we're going to take you out. In the party system, there's a reckoning right now, for sure.
And Miko, just to get back to what we were talking about in terms of, you know, Rosselló actually being ousted. I mean, if he were to go, whether he decides to step down, what do you see as the consequences for Puerto Ricans that you speak to that are on the island? And we've got less than a minute to go.
There's a lot of work to do. I mean, it's kind of like, I want this to be like a Puerto Rican style cleanup, you know, where you like in the marquesina, you take away all the furniture and then you like hose it down with Clorox and take away all the rats and cockroaches. And then you like get new furniture and like put everything back better than when I was there. And it's going to be a lot of work and a lot of years, but I'm really hopeful, from all the posts that I'm seeing from family and friends, people have a fire within them that I think will overrule any obstacles that come our way.
Vico Ortiz is an LA-based Latinx actor and activist, and Nicole Acevedo is a reporter with NBC News Digital. They were both born and raised in Puerto Rico. Thanks so much to you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And everybody, we want to hear your thoughts as well. Our Puerto Rican listeners, what are you thinking about all this? 877-8-MY-TAKE is our number. ¿Cuál es su opinión de la crisis en Puerto Rico? Llámenos al 877-869-8253. It's 2.5 years into his presidency, and President Trump has dramatically reshaped the nation's courts. According to the advocacy group Alliance for Justice, the president has appointed 38 more federal judges than former President Barack Obama had at this same point in his presidency. And those judges tend to have a strong conservative agenda, including some who have a history of being openly against LGBTQ rights, immigration, and abortion. Ellie Mistal is the executive editor of Above the Law and the legal editor of WNYC's More Perfect. And he recently profiled 7 of those judges for The Nation. Welcome to the show, Ellie.
Thanks for having me.
So give us an overall picture of how the courts have changed over the last several years.
Well, they've lurched right. And this has been the long-term plan of Donald Trump, of Mitch McConnell and the Federalist Society. Donald Trump is kind of just the puppet who's delivering them this victory. Look, the Trump appointees now account for 14% of the overall federal judiciary. They account for over 20% of the circuit courts, which is that level right below the Supreme Court. And, of course, it counts for 22% of the Supreme Court because he's got 2 of the 9 justices on. So the rapidity at which he has been able to reshape the courts during his short 2.5 years is, in fact, his lasting legacy. I mean, think about Trump. We're talking about a man with no legislative experience and no legislative accomplishments. All he's done has been done by executive order. Most of those executive orders can and hopefully will be overturned by the next president. But the courts, these people that he's appointing, these people are there for life, and they are going to shape the law for the next 30 years, what we're talking about.
So let's talk about, because this, as you said, this happened before Trump. I mean, let's talk about a little bit of the groundwork that the GOP laid before President Trump was elected. And I want to mention, you mentioned the Federalist Society. Tell us about them.
All right. So first, just with the groundwork, right? Everybody understands that Mitch McConnell blocked Barack Obama's nominee to the Supreme Court, Merrick Garland. But people don't understand that the Merrick Garland thing was the capstone on Mitch McConnell's career, right? Like that was just the tip of the iceberg. He had been blocking Obama judges consistently throughout Obama's term, even when McConnell was the minority leader. So that by the time Trump took office, there were 106 seats within the federal judiciary that had not been filled by Obama. Now, I don't know if that's a record because, you know, George Washington had a lot of seats open to appoint too, but somewhere along the way, like that 106 is an amazing amount of open seats. And that's why Trump, again, who doesn't really know what he's doing, has been able to fill with such rapidity. Now, the other side of this is that, okay, you have 106 seats open. Do you have 106 judges? And that's where the Federalist Society comes in. They have been planning this for a generation, right? So when you have this opening, the Federalist Society is a conservative, nonprofit legal group that claims to care about libertarian ideals and originalist thinking. But what that devolves to is promoting, incubating, training, finding arch-conservative justices who are against the progress that has been made since 1776.
But let's drill down into that, because if President Trump, as you've said, did quote, doesn't know what he's doing, at least at the legislative level, President Obama, some would argue, did know. He was a constitutional scholar, et cetera, et cetera. Why did the Democrats drop the ball in this, because it appears that having that many open seats would indicate not just that it was an Obama issue, but that there was some sort of systemic failure on the Democrat side. I mean, do they have an equivalent of the Federalist Society?
Right. So there's a lot to unpack there, and it's an important point. So first, let's start with the obvious. Like, Obama did try. McConnell was blocking him. At some point, you don't blame the person whose house it is because the arsonist came and burnt it down, all right? So, like, there's that, right? But beyond that, yes, I don't think that Obama and the Obama administration was hard enough and quick enough off the ball to fill the open seats that they could have filled when they had the Senate, when they had the 60-vote majority in the Senate. They were focused on other things. They weren't particularly focused on the courts. But that's not just a criticism of the Obama administration. That's a criticism of the entire Democratic Party and the entire progressive movement, which has, for a generation, been derelict in their duties about the Supreme Court. So that if you had given Barack Obama 106 open judges to fill, we don't have a list of 107 judges that we want to put on courts because we have not done the organizational homework that a thing like the Federal Society
and
has done.
That strikes me as a real failure on the party side here of the Democrats. I mean, how could you have that many folks who are saying that just have no idea?
There's also,
they're just not capable of putting it together.
Right. So, well, the Democrats have been afraid to argue for the courts, right? Like, the Republicans have been, Republican voters are not smarter than Democratic voters. They're not more informed than Democratic voters. They have been told, Republicans, that if you want to kill abortion, if you want to stop gay people from kissing on each other in public, that the way to do that is through the courts. Democrats have not been told that if you want women's rights and if you want voting rights and if you want marriage equality, then and if you want climate change policies and if you want reasonable gun regulation, then you have to control the courts in order to do that. The Democrats have not made that issue plain and clear to Democratic voters, and that is why Democratic voters do not vote in midterm elections and off-year elections for the kinds of Democratic senators who are going to appoint progressive judges the way Republicans reliably come out to vote, simply because they know that whoever has an R next to his name is going to end up supporting a Republican justice.
So there's a messaging failure on the part of the Democratic Party, but what
can I also just say there's a money failure, because that's being made really obvious, I think, in this election cycle. Apparently, if you're like a rich billionaire who's liberal, you think that the thing to do with your billions is to serve your ego and run for president. You don't think that the thing to do with your buildings is to start a movement, to start an organization, to start that counterpoint to the Federal Society, or to fund many of the Democratic organizations that are out there trying to fight the Federal Society. The Federal Society is only, you know, Dahlia Lithwick, who writes for Slate and is great, and if you don't read her, you're missing out. You should read her. She has this great line that turns out buying a Supreme Court is not all that expensive. Y'all, you need about $250 million, right? And Democrats have that money, but they don't put it into buying the courts. The Republicans do, and they have, and that is why they're winning.
Ellie Mistal is executive editor of Above the Law and legal editor of WNYC's More Perfect and a contributing reporter for The Nation. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Home cooking is the best, my friend, because once you've had it, you won't be hungry again, because it will nourish you deep within your soul. You won't be eating junk food no more.
Cooking is a physical experience that engages all of our senses. We touch, smell, see, hear, and most importantly, taste the food we make. But many of us also have a tangible connection to our cookbooks. Despite the accessibility of countless recipes and cooking videos online, printed cookbook sales are on the rise. And like the memories we share through food, these books can transcend time, becoming family heirlooms and even cultural artifacts.
Hi, this is Lori Hughes from Everett, Washington. I have cookbooks that have come from my grandmother, my grandfather, my aunts, my uncle. And they are part of my heritage, and the food that I cook is filled with love and family.
Patricia from Snohomish, Washington. I received my first cookbook as a gift from my mother, Betty Crocker's Picture Cookbook. I later found a vintage copy for my own daughter.
Hi, this is Monica from Oregon. My most important cookbook is the binder I have of family recipes from both my family and my husband's family. You can't Google those gems.
Thanks to all of you for telling us your stories of cookbooks that are meaningful to you, and we hope you'll keep them coming. With me now to talk more about why cookbooks have such an effect on us is Peter Meehan, the editor of the LA Times food section and the co-author of the Momofuku Cookbook. Peter, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
So what makes a good cookbook? Is it the pictures? Is it the recipes? Like, what is it?
I mean, I think it's individual to everyone. For me, I mean, I made cookbooks and they have lots of pictures in them, and I'm very passionate about the pictures in them, but pictures aren't essential to a cookbook. The cookbooks that I learned to cook from didn't have pictures in them. But I think it's a book that you find an emotional connection with and you have a relationship with. And I think that's the thing that distinguishes great cookbooks from, you know, paleo 30 recipe trend cookbooks. Not to disparage those books sell better than my books. I understand.
But there are, I mean, speaking about personal connections, I have a personal connection to a Puerto Rican cookbook called Cocina Criolla, which is sort of the master, you know, if you will, of all Puerto Rican dishes. And a couple of years ago, I decided, well, if I'm going to really learn my food, I'm going to try to make those original recipes, which is not always so simple, right? But do you find that people have family connections to cookbooks like that, that they have these deeper reasons for keeping certain cookbooks and recipes around?
Sure. I mean, I think many people have cookbooks that they have connections to because their family cooked out of them or their mom or their dad cooked out of them. I mean, for me, I grew up without food being a huge part of my life. But when I moved to New York, I lived above a used bookstore and I was unemployed and a college dropout. And I needed to learn how to cook so I could eat because I was broke. And I got Marcella Hazan's Classics, Essentials of Classic Italian Cooking. And that book, I mean, it was before Julie and Julia. I just cooked it cover to cover to learn about food. And Marcella Hazan has become... She's a person in my life, even though I never met her in the flesh, because that, you know, she's my Italian grandma. She is the person who taught me how to cook and how to think about food. And I think that that relationship that I have to that book is the relationship that many people have to books, you know, that their families cooked out of or that they found, like I did along the way, when they needed to find their way in the kitchen.
How do we explain the fact that print cookbooks, actual printed cookbooks, are doing so well in an era where we can, you know, and I've done this before, I'll look up a recipe and sometimes I'll combine two or three recipes that I find online to kind of make what I think is the best version of said food or said dish. Why is it that printed books are doing so well in this genre specifically?
I mean, I think it's because cooking is a physical act. And I think that there is a, you know, when you have a dish, like let's take Marcella's tomato onion butter sauce, which is like everybody's favorite pasta sauce. You can go on Food 52 and Google it and find it and look online. But there's something about reaching for that book on the shelf and opening up. And, you know, it's like so trite to say, but those splattered pages, like there's something in something important about the physical connection to that item and the physical action of cooking. And I think that there's... You know, people talk about reading cookbooks in bed, and I feel like it's a cheesy thing to even say, but there's something about that feeling of discovery and again, the intimacy. That's like the thing with Marcella being a person in my life. There's an intimacy to a book that there isn't to a website.
What about the fact that I'm going back to thinking about Cocina Criolla, and part of what I was trying to do there was not lose the foods that I had grown up eating, right? A lot of my generation... kind of took for granted that our abuelas were going to make certain dishes. And, you know, when you realize, you go, well, I haven't had a sorollito de maíz, which is a little corn fritter, or, you know, if you really want to take it to the next level, making pasteles, right? Like, I don't know how to do that. And I was worried that we would lose that link to our food, to our past. Is that part of the reason why you think cookbooks are doing well, too, that people are really looking for, like, the original, you know, sort of, you know, connection that they had to maybe something grandma made or something, you know, even prior to that, that they grew up eating that just isn't seen anymore or made anymore?
Yeah, I mean, I think cookbooks are they're a connection to culture, they're a connection to history, and they're a way to find a path back to pasteles, you know, if that is the thing that you need to make to recreate those feelings from your childhood, or they're a way to create your own connection to your culture or to you know, the way that you want to interact with the world. I mean, I know when I moved here, I got into eating in Chinatown because I could afford it and it was cool to discover. And then it became important to me to understand those dishes and how they were made and where they were from. And cookbooks are an amazing window to learn the building blocks of cuisine. And the, you know, like the secret of food is that when you start to learn about those things and you start to shop for those things and you start to go to those markets and hang out in those neighborhoods, you immerse yourself in other cultures and experiences that might not even be yours, but you develop a real world connection to them. And I think that that's a thing that cookbooks do. Is as much as they reinforce what we bring to the table, they offer a way for us to interact with and experience other cultures, you know, in a way that just like reading a novel by someone from a different background doesn't do, because it gives you a real world reason to go and interact with that community.
Peter Meehan is the editor of the LA Times food section and the co-author of the Momofuku Cookbook. Peter, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
And that's our show for today. You can always find us on Facebook and leave a comment there, and follow us on Instagram for some behind-the-scenes action. And of course, call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or tweet us at The Takeaway. And I want to give a shout-out to the folks who help make this show run every day. Our production staff this week is Alexandra Boti, Isabel Angel, Lee Hill, Ethan Oberman, Jose Olivares, Jason Tureski, Andres O'Hara, Meg Dalton, and Paula Mora. Our tech team and sound designers are Jake Howitt and Vince Fairchild, and our digital editor is Polly Irungu. David Gable is our assistant, and our intern is Jivika Varma. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.